And welcome back to All Things Whiskey Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Outcall. Today on the show, we have two special guests joining us from Westland Distillery. We have Tyler Peterson, the master distiller, and Shane Armstrong, the master blender. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's exciting to be part of the podcast.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I've been a fan of what Westland has been doing the past few years now, and I just saw you all won some big awards. I'm just curious, maybe give us like your elevator pitch to start the episode off. Why Westland? That's really what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, Westland, we try to make whiskey with a sense of place. And for us, what that really starts with is malted barley. Our region just happens to grow great quality malted barley. And so single malt is really the name of the game when it comes to what we produce. It's the only style of whiskey that we really focus on. And it's not just the raw materials like barley, but we also work with a native oak species called Quercus garryana, and we make some whiskey with that. And we also look to use some peat from a local peat bog to smoke some of the barley that we use. So there's the raw materials that influence our whiskey production, but also the cultural kind of approaches to beverage production and innovation that a lot of the kind of people are known here for, our brewing friends, our winemaking industry, and then tech and biomedical. We do a lot here that's kind of pushing the envelope on kind of old world traditions and adding our own perspective on it.
Yeah, I love that answer. And that laid out a perfect map for all the questions that I want to ask and talk about when it comes to Westland today. You know, you mentioned sense of place, and Westland's based out of the Seattle, Washington area. Why that area? Can you tell me more about why that's a great place for making whiskey?
Yeah, so I mentioned barley, and we are, it may not seem like it, but we're a grain producing state. We grow a lot of wheat in the region. We also grow a fair amount of barley too. And it's all, a lot of it is really high quality malting grade barley. We've got an industry, a brewing industry that's been here since the craft brew boom in the 80s that has kind of focused a lot of malt house development here. So it brings that raw material from a raw barley form and into that malted barley that we need. So our raw materials are here both in quality, and the supply chains to deliver that is relatively short. And then when it comes to making whiskey, we mature our whiskey in oak barrels, right? And climate plays a big factor into that. We're a relatively rainy climate with a lot of moisture in the air. And being so close to the ocean, we're relatively tempered in terms of our climate swings, our temperature swings throughout the day and throughout the year, so that we're not experiencing the same extreme highs and lows that might be seen in other parts of the country. For us, we age a lot of our whiskey in new American oak casks. So the tannin structure and the wood or the sugar component that can be extracted can be quite intense if we were to be maturing in a different environment. But the kind of natural mellow expansion and contraction cycles that we see really align themselves nicely to our style of whiskey.
Sure. And that's in stark contrast to somewhere like Kentucky, where you're making bourbon and they, you know, affectionately say they have terrible weather there. So extreme cold, extreme hot. When you have more temperate climate, you've got the kind of that standard consistency for making American single malts. Do you see any parallels between Seattle, Washington and, like, let's say Scotland?
We do. And, you know, some of the breeding labs that we've worked with for barley development, they've certainly identified our kind of local region and some of the micro regions within Washington state as being relatively comparable to some of the Scottish conditions. You know, it's a big place and there's a lot of variability within our state, but we certainly do have pockets where you can see the similarities pretty nicely. You know, we do see a lot of evaporative losses to ethanol over the course of the years because we've got so much moisture in the air. That's kind of a contrast to our counterparts in Kentucky who see the water evaporating. And so I think that's what you're going to see and experience a lot in many situations in Scotland too. And Shane, correct me if I'm wrong at any point here. So we kind of see a lot of the similarities from the growing regions to the maturation climates being somewhat similar.
Yeah, maturation being on the western side of the Cascades, not the eastern side, because the east is where a lot of agriculture happens and is much drier and hotter.
Okay. And going back to that sense of place too, you mentioned culture in Seattle and Washington State. I'm really interested to see if you've seen a shift into whiskeys and American single malts. I know that wine has been huge in that area as well.
You're starting to see certainly more distilleries make a big move into whiskey production, and different styles too. We've got some really great bourbon producers, some great rye whiskey is produced here. It can be harder to source some of those ingredients, not nearly impossible by any means, but rye is considered a noxious weed in some counties, so it's we can't always grow it, but nevertheless, it's still readily available material. And so yeah, we're starting to see a big boom in the whiskey producers here in the region, in Seattle and in the greater Pacific Northwest. So it's an exciting kind of group to be a part of because a lot of us do have some sort of brewing background or outside influences in the beverage industry world that are we're being brought into this perspective.
Sure. And as a part of that, how long has Westland been making whiskeys and American single malts?
We started distilling in 2011, and our first release was in 2013.
Okay. So you've got some good tenure in there, over what, 14, 13 years of experience now?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we got
And
some
it.
older ones. Sometimes I joke about the older ones. When these other companies come out with their like 50-year-old and things, it just means that it wasn't good enough.
Yeah, we've seen that with some older expressions too, and a lot of like award-winning stuff at like 13, 14 years. You know, our podcast co-host was the first person to just go, "Well, if you're releasing most of your stuff at 9 or 8 or 10 or 12, what's wrong with this one?"
Yeah.
I see some really old Scotch brands too, like Talisker's doing 46-year-olds, right? And they're going to cost you an arm and a leg if you want one. So, what is that balance of age that you're looking for when you're making your whiskeys?
Like for particular releases, like an age window. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I'm curious for kind of like core expressions or yeah, particular releases. What do you think that sweet spot is when it comes to American single malts?
I mean, I can't speak for all American single malts, but for us, it's kind of an interesting thing because we're filling a fair amount into new oak. And sort of, you'd think if you put a single malt into a new American oak cask, eventually it's going to get over oaked and get too tannic in this. But actually, what we've noticed over time is that there's interesting ester development. So the fruity character sort of competes with these oaky characteristics. So I'm thinking it can age like a fair amount longer than we thought. So as of right now, for our 5 malt recipe that goes into new oak, that shows up in flagship, it can be from 4 to 7 or 8 for that one. But it's kind of all focused on the casks that we use. We use some air-dried casks, so some of the tannins are broken down a bit. So I think they don't take over quite as much as you would think with a kiln-dried wood.
Okay, very interesting. And I've got a glass of the flagship here. And so maybe can you tell me a little bit more about the flagship whiskey and what goes into that?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know how. Actually, have you tasted it yet? It might be interesting for you to taste it, and talk me through a second, and then I'll tell you what's in it.
Sure, I'm about an ounce in already. I was doing a little
Oh, an ounce in.
pre-show. Yeah, but I've got a little
All right.
bit, so let me pour some here and then I'll tell you what I think. I wrote some notes. I'm getting some really interesting stuff. Spoiler, I think it's delicious. I think it's a great core product. So this is really fun. And maybe while I'm doing that, we can get some insight from you guys too, Tyler and Shane. You know, why American single malt? I know you mentioned that it's a resource that you have available in the Pacific Northwest, but I think American single malt tends to get a bad name sometimes. People look at it and they say it's not bourbon, it's not rye, it's not scotch. Why is this an exciting expression and what do you like about making American single malts?
I mean, from our perspective, we're taking something that's been very traditional, sometimes bogged down by tradition, in Scotland, and like focusing on each step of the process. So I mentioned our 5 malt recipe. So we're using some malts that are roasted and kilned to different levels. So we're building a malty profile with that. That's influenced by the beer culture. I mean, obviously, beer uses these different malts. In our fermentation, we're using a Saison style yeast. So we're getting a lot of flavor development in our fermenters. A lot of the fruitier notes and Some of the spicy notes are coming from that, which you don't see that a lot in Scotland. And we're putting in New American oak. Like that's another thing you don't see in Scotland very much. So I think being where we are in the US lends itself to trying these different things and like refocusing on each step while still like our if two stills, pot distillation, like that's very traditional on that side, taken from Scotland. Sort of combining these two factors of like progression, innovation, and then done with a nod to and in the style of a Scottish single malt.
Sure. And when I get to tasting and tell you about my notes, I think some of that's going to resonate with you, everything you just said there. But a lot of the core Scotch expressions, you're trying to get the smoothest, non-spicy expression that you can. You're using oftentimes used American oak. Jack Daniel's the largest supplier of used American oak to Scotland. Fun fact of the day. And you know, when we talked about like older expressions coming out where you say they might be over oak too, you know, you've had a lot of people in the market too releasing very young expressions. So I think when I hear you're been around for 13 years, you have a really diverse series of age statements there that I think are going to result in great whiskey, especially if you're putting those in New American oak.
Yeah, for sure. So the biggest supplier being Jack Daniel's. Those casks are really reliable. It's interesting the like the variability you can get within ex-bourbon casks, because it's kind of this like, oh, it's just a monolith, like they fill ex-bourbon casks. But from our experience, like Jack Daniel's casks were really, really reliable and consistent, which was nice for some things as a blending tool, but other ones are more variable, so you can kind of play the different characters against each other, which is cool.
Sure. And cask variability is such an interesting topic, too. We actually, a couple episodes ago, had Dr. Tom Collins, the endowed Jackson Family Wines endowed professor of viticulture and enology at Washington State University. So he was talking about how they measure chemical reactions in charring barrels in his chemistry lab and the impact that that has on making whiskey. Really, really interesting conversation when you start to look at that aspect of making whiskey.
Yeah, what a name too.
Yeah, Dr. Tom Collins. I had to drink a Tom Collins on the podcast. You guys, you know, it's Tyler Peterson and Shane Armstrong, right? I can't make any cocktails with that.
Yet. Yeah, just wait.
But I've got delicious whiskey in my glass. So when I dive into this, the first thing that hits me is fruity sweetness. You get red apple, green apple together, honey. But then it smells a little smoky to me. And I think maybe that comes from that New American oak. And I was going to ask you if this has any sherry influence in it too, because I get kind of those red wine notes, the dark red fruits. I get some of that on the nose from this core expression.
Yeah, for sure. This is why you're a master taster, as they say. Yeah, it does have a little bit of peat, and it also has a little bit of Oloroso in it. So, like, these
Okay.
are these nods, like, we nod to Scotland with our process of distillation, and having a little some Oloroso and some peat is like a reference to the past. Kind of like what you're saying there. It's not overt in any way. This is what's interesting when people taste it. You have these two camps, I feel like. Like, oh, I like the sherry, and they don't even mention the peat, or like, oh, there's peat in it, and they don't even mention the sherry.
Sure.
So that's an interesting tasting experience. But the entire backbone is this five malt recipe that's aged in new oak, is the vast majority of it.
Yeah, I was tasting this and I was second guessing myself a little. I'm like, it tastes kind of sherried. And I was like, it tastes kind of smoky. And I'm like, I wonder if it is or not. I'm gonna put those notes down and I guess we'll see. So
This is the deal. I mean, this is the stuff that I love about tasting, is this like confusion. It's like something we call like high complexity, low clarity that we talk about. And like I always like to think about these whiskeys regardless of the actual notes that you're getting. Like what's the relationship between the notes? And if you can get someone to be like, I think I get this, but maybe it's this, all of a sudden it becomes like much more interesting of a whiskey.
Sure. You know, I was rooting around there too. I get a little bit of like bran muffin smelling that.
Yeah,
And then
classic.
when I'm tasting this too, it's rich, viscous, big vanillas, big fruity flavors, nice back end spice. I think it's a really enjoyable expression. And if you are someone who likes scotch and you haven't dipped that toe into American single malts yet, this seems like it'd be a perfect place to start.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And to your earlier question about why single malt, it's what's in this glass or what is represented in this glass, you know, to us is the opportunity that this category offered, right? There's a lot of old world traditions and history and knowledge that goes into making the single malts that we love from Scotland, but also there's so much left on the table due to the kind of strict environment that they have built for themselves to create that strong identity. They weren't using a lot of specialty malts that are roasted and kilned. You know, their yeast strain is pretty much nearly ubiquitous across any distillery that you go to, right? It's this M strain variant. And they're all using X bourbon casks, you know, might all be from nearly the same distillery, right? And so for us, the opportunity to add to that long history, but doing so in a way that added some really interesting and compelling complexity into the glass was something that was an opportunity we hadn't seen before, but knew that we could find some space to really run and create something, you know, kind of unique.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think complexity is a word that I love when you're describing this whiskey, because this is your core product. We have the special releases here that we're going to talk about or some different iterations of it. But for a core product, there's deep robustness in flavor, smell, tasting experience here. I think that's really, really enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, so we bottle everything. We're not chill filtering anything. We're not adding coloring. So our flagship expression is at 46% ABV. So you're getting a rather full kind of breadth of that, what that cask and that original marriage of spirit types has to offer. And so you can kind of approach that if you're feeling like tonight's the night for just a straight dram, perfect. Or if you need to add a drop of ice or water, or, you know, mix this up into a cocktail, a Boulevardier is kind of one of the go-to classics that our team loves this expression in. A paper plane, for a little bit of peat that's in there, when you make a flip with it, add some egg white and the lemon, brings the kind of chocolate notes to the forefront of the palate. So it's a really great whiskey to approach from a bunch of different perspectives. So yeah, we're really happy with it. Shane's been knocking it out of the park.
I was going to ask you what the cocktails were that you would make out of this too. And that seems like a great list right there too. I'm wondering if maybe you could even do like a rusty nail here with some of this if you wanted to.
Yeah,
for sure. Easy.
Mm-hmm.
Although I will say it's an easy drinker, neat too. So try it that way first before you start making some cocktails, or, you know, do whatever you want. It's your whiskey if you buy a bottle of Westland here. Now, you mentioned we're on that topic of why American single malt. I know there's a lot of legislation that's been tied up and they're trying to pass the actual parameters for defining American single malt. Are you in favor or against that? I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that debate.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we're in favor of. We were kind of one of the founding members of the American Single Malt Whiskey Commission. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was in 2016 when we got together with the seven other kind of founding members, sat down in a room after a conference and started to hash out the guidelines that we thought would be appropriate. And it was really done with this mentality of making sure that anybody around the world could pick up a bottle of American single malt and roughly know what they were getting into. So it was going to protect that consumer while also protecting us as an industry from kind of some of the more nefarious habits that can or have developed, you know, with taking whiskey that isn't from this place and then slapping American single malt on the label. And it's also the definitions were, we felt, broad enough that allowed the kind of American innovation that we're so well known for, right? You can use a column still if that's what you have equipment for. We're not demanding you distill on or off the grain. A number of cask types can be used as long as you're not maturing in something over 700 liters, which is exceptionally and unfeasibly large to mature proper whiskey in. You know, we're leaving it open while still maintaining some of those core values of both the American category, you know, distillation proofs, bottling proofs, things like that, and the Scottish tradition of 100% malted barley distilled at one distillery. So we feel like it's a very happy medium in order to kind of help this tide rise and lift all boats. And now I think there's over 120 official members of the American Single Malt Whiskey Commission, and there's probably closer to 200 of us that are actually making it in the country now. So,
yeah, very cool. And you're not alone in that too, right? I mean, starting with bourbon, it's a federally regulated term. There's all these strict ways that you have to make it. I think maybe they're even more restrictive than what and how you can make American single malt. But Japanese whiskey recently defined what Japanese whiskey is too, and it pushed some brands out that were calling themselves Japanese whiskey. So it's a really interesting debate as that continues to evolve. As like you said, if you pick up a bottle of American single malt anywhere, you roughly have an idea of what you're getting into there. I think that's really interesting. And without any of that, it seems like it could be kind of the wild, wild west, no pun intended, of, you know, making whiskey, right? What's in this? How is it done? How is it aged? What does it even mean in this category?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that many kind of modern whiskey consumers and connoisseurs are really after is that degree of transparency. And because we're generally the industry, the American single malt whiskey industry, is small and young, and the producers are small. We're quite frankly very often willing to talk about all of the details that's going on in the glass and what got us there. And so it's kind of a different perspective. It's a very open door policy in terms of the free flowing information that a lot of us have, because we want to bring more people into the category. And it's a lot about, we recognize education, right? Educating people into what is whiskey, what is not bourbon and not rye, and still American single malt, right? There's, I think any of us will go out on a given month and talk to people, and someone will say, "Oh yeah, I don't like whiskey, but I like bourbon." And you're like, "Well, let's talk about the umbrella category and how these terms actually come to be, because there's a lot of confusion out there." So it's just one of the challenges with the opportunity.
Sure. It's one of my favorite things to do in whiskey tastings that I host too, is to do a blind and say, what is this? Is it a bourbon, a rye, American single malt? You know, generally I'll throw in something like a Scotch or Japanese too, which it's never going to be unless they, you know, specifically request that. But how do you pick out those flavors and those notes? How do you differentiate between them? I think the answer is, you know, drink a lot of whiskey, right? Start identifying the core components that go into that and how these are all made, how they're aged, what they're mash bill looks like, and you'll start to become really good at identifying again what type of whiskey that is.
Yeah, and we have something internally that Shane has developed that's pretty fun and near and dear to the most people's hearts on our team. That's Whiskey Wednesday, which I can imagine most distilleries or operations have something slightly similar. But Shane, do you want to kind of talk about that experience?
Yeah, we just do a blind tasting on a Wednesday of all days, you know, because it begins with a W. So we do one, and we work through this grid that we developed that kind of mirrors the sommelier's deductive tasting grid. So it's kind of what you're saying is you have a grid that you work through, and eventually at the end, you can take the evidence from that and try to deduce what it is specifically. Like, yeah, what kind of whiskey it is, if it even is a whiskey. Maybe where it's from, the cask type, and things like that. But that also ties into what I said earlier, is discussing things without particular notes. I mean, we give our notes just to start thinking about it, but we split up our tasting into like relative strength of different elements of a whiskey. So we talk about grain, cask, ester, other, and we sort of rate them on a scale of relative strength. So what's dominating the glass, because you write a bunch of tasting notes and it doesn't necessarily give you the full experience, or give you if this note is carrying more weight than this note. We also use some words that I like, with like texture or intensity, and complexity, that's a common one, and clarity is one that's interesting, like how well can you parse the notes on the nose or the palate. It's like a compelling way to talk about a whiskey.
Yeah, and it is an acquired skill too. So if you're just getting into this and doing blind tastings, keep at it, right? You have to hone those smells and the flavors that you get to try to identify age and type and location, right? I 100% believe in terroir, and I'm sure if you compare this American single malt here to something like our local, right, we're going to see some big differences.
And I also like in tastings where people who are new to tasting are always somewhat hesitant, because it's weird to, you know, talk about what you smell. Usually it's like some intense experience of smell, like good or bad, but to talk about the nuances is weird. So I just tell people, like, whatever you're thinking in this moment is part of the tasting experience. So, like, feel free to share anything. Even if you haven't tasted whiskey ever before, like, you're having an experience, and it's fine to, like, if it's not a specific note, to say what you're experiencing.
Yeah, I always like to say no wrong answers, right? Like, whatever you're thinking, smelling, tasting, experiencing during that drinking experience, right? There's no wrong answers. Now, one of my good friends, his wife, she says every whiskey tastes like permanent markers, though. So,
yeah, I love permanent markers, though. I like distilled permanent markers.
It sounds like a negative connotation to me when she's talking about permanent markers, yeah. But you know, that's a distinct smell, I'll tell you what.
It's not like mezcal where people are getting psyched on burning plastic or something like that.
So we've experienced the flagship American single malt, and then I've got some other whiskeys that we can run through here too and talk about them. The first one I poured here is the Colere.
Yeah. That's how we say it.
The Stephen Colere.
Yeah, that's the full name.
So what can you tell me about this expression?
Colere is Latin for to cultivate, and this the Colere series is part of our Outpost range, where in the Outpost range we're looking kind of at a few of our key raw materials with a greater degree of intent. So Colere is featuring barley varieties, elements of terroir, and conceptually looking at how agricultural practices can influence the whiskey. We'll get into Garryana later, which features the Quercus Garryana, the native oak species, and then Solum, which is Latin for soil, and that is our peated expression. Colere, and specifically the release two that you've got in front of you, is a focus on a single barley variety called Talisman. Talisman is a descendant of the Maris Otter genetics. So Maris Otter is kind of a more heritage variety of barley that was developed in the mid-60s. And brewers and distillers really found it beneficial for its flavor production. It was very malty, grain forward, rich, and also yielded well and kind of nicer than the other varieties at the time. Gradually, more varieties were developed that were kind of a little bit more modern and yielded better. So it faded in out of favor, but the variety still has a place in brewers and distillers' hearts. So Talisman is a descendant of that. This variety was being really bred and used in the British brewing industry in the early 2000s. And we found it through our malt house, Skagit Valley Malting. And a couple of their farmers started to grow it. Generally lower protein content on it, which is great. That means there's more starch to be able to fill into that grain and we get a higher yield. But also that protein, when you boil that, the fermented wash, those proteins form a lot of foam, and that rises up the still and can basically limit the rate of distillation. So we want a low protein variety. And from the start, when we first distilled this, it was very, very clear that there was a really interesting kind of nose on the spirit. The new make spirit had a lot of kind of tangerine like elements, a little more tropical leaning. And it was really kind of interesting and ester forward right off the bat. Now, after the fact, we've got this whiskey in the glass that has been maturing for just under 5 years, 4 years, 357 days.
Yeah, literally just under 5 years. It's sort of a hilarious dump age.
Yeah, it limbo danced under that 5 year mark. But with the Colere series, we largely try to focus on used cooperage. So ex-bourbon or ex-Westland cask, because ex-Westland, we know the history of that barrel. As Shane mentioned, we're using slow growth oak with air-dried staves, either 18 or 24 months. These ones were the Cooper's Reserve cast, so 24-month air-dried staves with a heavy toast and a light char. Overall, I think 12 casks made up this release. And it's really an interesting one. It's a two-row winter variety sown in the kind of September, fall months. It overwinters, provides some cover crop, and then farmers get to harvest it a little bit earlier in like July. So it's good for farmers in terms of they like winter varieties. They can plant it when there's less time or less to do. And you know, I think it's a really interesting new make spirit, and the finish spirit is just lovely.
Yeah, and when you talk about that tangerine and the fruitiness on the nose, you can smell that. And I think that there's this underlying chocolatiness that comes with it too. Fruity chocolate flavors. And then when I take a sip of that, very creamy on the palate, tons of chocolate. We're stepping up in proof, up to 50%, 100 proof. And you're using used cooperage. So sharpness of the spice comes through even more. And it feels to me like almost port finished, right? If I drink a red breast that's tawny port finished or another whiskey that's been aged in port casks, I always tend to get kind of the sharpness that comes with it. And I get a good amount of that there on this expression. But this is very delicious, very easy to drink too.
Yeah, especially with the refill ones. So our, like Tyler says, this is 12 casks of adding, seven of which were first fill bourbon, and the other five were refill of our own casks that had previously had five malt in it. So there's like a very subtle carryover, like the chocolate nose developed by some of the cask, but also there's carryover from that five malt that was in the cask previously.
Yeah, and
I
that's
really
a
like
really
those refills.
Really interesting comparison from the flagship moving into this, because you're going from new oak to used oak, different barleys, different proofings, different cooper. Yeah, I mentioned the used oak already, but the flavors change drastically on that. And I think both are very enjoyable expressions.
Yeah, the common thread with that is just the yeast, like that ester development is the common thread. And the fact that we distilled it, like the barley's different and the cooperage is different.
Very nice. I'm going to pour the Garryana next. And thank you all for getting these samples out to me. I appreciate the opportunity to try some of this. We do have Westland whiskey out in Colorado too. And maybe while I'm pouring that, an easy question to ask is, what states are you in right now and what markets are you looking to go to next?
I know we've got strong distribution in probably 38 of the states, with a company called Reserve Bar making up the final mile for those other states where we don't have direct distribution contracts in place. So you can find us if you're not being able to simply find us at your local liquor store and some of the larger ones like the national chains, right? You'll certainly be able to find us. But you can go to our website, westlandwhiskey.com, and our store can link you to Reserve Bar and make that transaction a little bit more easy for you if you're needing to ship to your house.
Fantastic.
Internationally, I think we're in 11 international markets overall. So starting to get it out there beyond the pond and really gain some traction out there.
I was going to say, have you tasted this Garryana yet?
I'm smelling it. usually when I'd sit down and do tastings, I take a good 30 minutes, 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Really tune out everything else in my life, right? I want to dive in. I want to be fully immersed in whatever that drinking experience is going to be and dive deep into the flavors, the smells, the drinking experience, right? Take my time, dig deep, look for some hidden things. This right off the bat, I poured some in my glass and I was like, it smells like woodsy fruity pebbles.
Yeah, it's big. It's big for sure.
Big,
yeah,
bright flavors right there on the nose. It's got the cereal, the fruit, the wood, the oak that comes through on that.
Yeah, my little tasting chamber at the distillery is kind of hilarious. It's a pressure positive little room, so all the air flows out and nothing comes in because I'm kind of buffered by the kitchen. So if someone's heating up some, I don't know, chili or something in the microwave, the smell doesn't get in there. That's a nice room to focus and go through samples on.
Yeah, Tyler doesn't take a shower, you know, that doesn't waft into the room while you're doing the tastings
Yeah,
and the blendings.
Exactly.
I've never showered, so it's not been an issue.
It's fine, yeah.
It's all part of
the
terroir now.
Yeah.
But yeah, let me try a little bit of this here and let's see what we can find. The nose is beautiful on those. Really, really nice though.
Yeah, so Garryana Lake Claret is part of our outpost range where we're sort of exploring the region more in depth that we're in. This one specifically is focusing on the cask, the species of oak that just grows in that part of the country, as opposed to Quercus alba, which most whiskey casks are made from. So that first, like those big hits that you're getting off the bat of like calling it woodsy fruity pebbles, kind of like a hybrid of these notes, is like the woodsy thing is the Gary Oak just jumping out immediately. This one in particular, we always sort of play or I play Gary Oak, these big notes against other notes. So it's not 100% Gary Oak. This one is 46%, but I'm playing those notes off of some Washington red wine casks. So that's another extension of the region that we're in. There's all these wineries that you can get casks from, age our spirit in, and then you end up with fattings like this.
Okay, and I'm looking for the proof here too. So we're at 50%, 100
50,
proof.
yeah.
The first sip I got of this, the note that stood out to me the most was grapefruit. Like it was a very grapefruity on the palate. Orange, melons, a lot of citrus that's popping up there. And then there's an underlying kind of bouncing peppery spice that goes with it too.
Yeah, that the sort of the exaggerated spice note is a Gary Oak signature. I used to say this even before the movies came out, but anyone familiar with Dune and the spice, it's
The
this
spice.
powerful spice that runs the universe, or it's like nondescript, and sometimes that's the way I think about Gary Oak. It's just the spice. You know, it can come in many forms and it has a lot of power.
The spice must flow through your glass. Yeah, that's a fun expression. It is, I think, fruity, tannic, spicy on the back end too. Spice lingers there for a while, so I think spice is great on this one.
Yeah, it sticks around too. You're talking about tasting something for 30 minutes. This is something that's really going to develop over that time frame. Like whiskeys will change generally, but this one shifts around more dramatically than other ones.
I think you
Yeah.
get some of those vanillas, the chocolates, a little bit floral there too, but some of the darker red fruit notes coming through as well.
Yeah, Shane, do you want to speak to some of the challenges of working with this oak species, because you're talking a lot about the big flavors, but I don't know, that may be hard to connect just over a podcast, but this whiskey is very, very aggressive. Can you speak to, or not the whiskey, but the oak species and its
Just the oak
character?
species in general. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have very much wood sugar, so it brings almost no sweetness to the table. So if you have 100% Gary Oak, it really dries out the palate, and is not always the most pleasant experience. So you want to harness those cool, like concentrated clove notes, and like you're saying, the woodsiness, and obviously the melange, the spice. So you want to focus those on the nose a bit and put in casks that will complement it on the nose, but also bring a little bit of sweetness to the palate to make it more full.
Okay, very
It's a
nice.
little bit
And
of wrestling.
the Garryana too just won some big awards. Can you tell me about that?
That was a Garryana 8, so one of number three in Whiskey Advocate's most exciting whiskeys this year. So that was fun. It's always nice to get these awards, and then I'm always sort of scratching my head and what made Garryana 8 so great versus all these other ones, the 8th one. But yeah, we were super happy about it. It's always nice to get that recognition, like first American single malt to be that high on the list. Yeah, it means a lot.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, Shane, you we can certainly kind of pontificate about why. One of the things that I love about that release, the 8th release, the most recent release of Garryana, is the interplay of PX, Pedro Ximénez, with this oak species because of its lack of sweetness and its overall intensity. I really admire the way that Pedro Ximénez kind of softens some of that tannin structure and adding a little bit of that sweetness to it without being too cloying. I think is a really interesting complement to the structure of this oak species and its intensity. And so that's certainly a feature of this eighth release is a little bit of Garryana, or not Garryana, I'm sorry, Pedro Ximénez.
Yeah, the PX in version 8 were pretty standout too, not in that they were concentrated, it's actually they were pretty pulled back. Because not only you think of PX, you think of like a very concentrated wine, which it is, and it's sweet, but these ones had a lot of floral characteristics too. So it brought sweetness, but it also brought these floral notes that played against the Garry Oak really well.
Yeah, and if you want something completely unique that you're not going to get anywhere else, try the Garryana and experience the Garry Oak for yourself, right? Do you know of anybody else that's making whiskey with Garry Oak?
I know that there's a bunch actually. McCarthy, single malt out of Oregon, Portland, right? They've been using Quercus Garryana exclusively for maturing their heavily peated single malt since, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s. We've got a couple other distilleries that are using and finishing in it. I think Burnside Bourbon down in Portland is also using it. Interestingly, the Method and Madness, Irish whiskey distillers,
sure.
They just released a Garryana finished whiskey as well. So that to me is really exciting to kind of start to see this oak species get out there into the broader world of the whiskey and see what other distillers and their perspectives on it are. I think it's really exciting and also a small stamp of approval to the work that Shane and the rest of the team is doing here in kind of highlighting the quality of these potential ingredients.
Sure. And Rose and I went to Middleton Distillery, County Cork in 2021. We got engaged in Killarney, Ireland. So a special place in our heart, but they had the Method Madness side distillery there next to the largest pot still in the world. And that's a flashback to how you define Irish whiskey is that it has to be aged in a wooden cask and they leave that open. So you could use Garry Oak for that if you wanted to. Now, yeah. Shane, have you tried 100% Garry Oak aged whiskey and you just said, I can't do this. We got to blend some sweetness in here. What was that experience like?
No, not necessarily. I would say for the vatting, I think it's better as a whiskey. It's more complete to blend it out. But there's Garry Oak single cast that we released really early. Yeah, and like the what was like 115 or 116, really early on, just to be like, this is wild. Like,
sure,
you haven't tasted anything like this. It's a single cask, and like that's probably the arena for it is like a single cask is meant to be this like it's a little bit of an exaggeration. This is a particular point in time that expresses something that can be a little more exaggerated. I think for the full release, of adding works better. It's not necessarily that it's like so off-putting because I'm sure some people out there
sure.
would like it. Like really like tannic red wines, people enjoy those. So
yeah, and I think that's testament too to your skill as a master blender is finding that profile that you're looking for. And then when you release those single casts too, it's crazy to see how different they can be from a standard expression. Just one barrel of whiskey at one location at one point of time can vary just so differently from some of the other things that you're blending together.
Yeah, I try not to put too much emphasis on the master. I don't think I'm a master of anything. But it's also a testament to our stocks. We've like said yes to buying like a big variety of stocks. Like in terms of unique combinations, like we have like 1,000 or so unique combinations between the spirit type, the cask type, the finish cask type, like the type of beer that was in a cask before we finished in it. So there's a lot of different combinations that open up for single cask and for blending.
Yeah, and that resonates with me too, where you said you're not a master, right? You called me a master taster. I'm just a guy who drinks a lot of whiskey.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm like, I'm here. I'm just, you know, mixing it together.
Absolutely. And I think so far these have been three really fun expressions. We are moving on to the Solum. That's what I poured in my glass here too. So what can you tell me about this expression that we have?
This is a really exciting release for us. Solum Edition 2 is our most recent kind of special release, just brought out to the world in February 10th, featuring peated malt. So the malt was smoked with peat that was sourced locally here in Washington out of a bog near Shelton, Washington, if anybody's familiar. But what's really exciting about this is, I mean, as far as I know and can tell, and I'm willing to be corrected, this is probably the first time that North American peat has been used to make a single malt whiskey, period, which is pretty cool. But even more cool than that is just the relative biodiversity that we see in this particular bog. It's just amazing. It's, I'd argue, way more biodiverse than anything you're going to see out in Scotland, where it's just kind of the standard rolling hills of sphagnum mosses and sedge grasses and things like that. But this is, it's essentially a lake that's never been drained. So they're harvesting from below the waterline using an excavator, which is probably the least romantic part about this story. But because that lake is remaining intact, they're not releasing any of the carbon that's been sequestered in the soil. We're not degrading that ecosystem that's providing us with this raw material. And we're able to be relatively selective. We can say, okay, at 10 feet down, the peat composition is this. At 15 feet down, we can see this thin layer of ash when Mount Mazama blew its lid a couple thousand years ago. That's Crater Lake for anybody that's in the know. And so we can look at, you know, specific depths, specific microclimates within this bog, and try to identify, you know, differences in flavor that may exist, and tell a story that is very unique, uniquely American, but in a way that is kind of has a historical legacy to it. So this
Yeah.
whiskey again starts its way out in ex Westland casks. So I think this is a 20 cask blend that you're seeing, and it's an interesting construction. When we first started getting the peated malt in 2016, the malt house had never done that before. They'd never smoked barley, and so the initial delivery was very, very low in the PPMs, parts per million total phenols for those interested. And it's a way of measuring the smoke, and it was so almost non-peated when we first got that delivery. So we made a batch of whiskey with that. And then over the next 3 years, we worked with the malt house to try and rework their kiln, work on the R&D to figure out when was the right moisture content, the right time to introduce the smoke. And by 2019, the PPMs on that malt delivery was around 20. And so what's in
Okay.
your glass is a blend of the 2016 and the 2019 batches coming together.
Sure. And for reference, if you want like what's heavily peated, what's not, Port Charlotte from Bruichladdich, they're heavily peated is 40 ppm. So you're at 20 here in this peat. But what's really interesting to me, number one, amazing. I love the fusion of peat into American whiskeys. Our friends down at Liberty Pole Distilling do a peated American rye. That's fantastic. So when I heard about this peated American single malt, I was so excited to try this. I think it's kind of that next frontier, and that smoke can add so much robustness to different types of spirits. People ask me for food pairings all the time, and they're like, "What do I pair with a steak?" And I'm like, "Something with peat." What do I pair with a cod, something with peat? I'm like, look, if you're doing chocolates or fruits, bourbons are great. American single malts are great too. You add that peat and that extra layer of robustness, you get an experience that complements, I feel like, almost anything. And if you're listening to this saying, I'm scared of smoke, don't be with this expression, because when I smell this on the nose, I get cinnamon red hot candies, very marshmallowy, very deep fruit notes to it, and the smoke is complementary to all of that as well.
Yeah. And because it's a composition of those two different production years, right? The earthy, leathery, mossy kind of petrichor notes from those earlier 2016 batches and a much more robust smoke of the 2019. You know, we probably are thinking that this is landing around 8 to 12 ppm as a finished whiskey, which is a great way to kind of approach this category for those unfamiliar. But also, like you're saying, like this whiskey pairs phenomenally well with some foods. And one of my favorites is, you know, it's kind of a tradition to add a drop of smoky whiskey onto oysters. And this does it in a way that has a better sense of place than any I've ever seen. There's literally like this, the Peatbog is in between two straits of water. One is Oyster Bay, and the other is where Taylor Shellfish harvests a lot of their oysters. And so, you know, to pour a whiskey on top of an oyster where the Peatbog, you know, is 100 yards away from where the oysters are harvested, the barley in Skagit Valley is a mile away harvested from where the oyster is harvested up in Skagit area up there. Like, this is a whiskey with a sense of place and a pairing and a sense of place. And it's a lot of fun to explore.
Can you guys hang on for like 30 minutes while I run to the store and get some oysters real quick, or a restaurant to try this?
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah. Get shucking.
You're not busy master distillers or blenders, right?
I'm just hanging. And cask breakdown, this, like Tyler was saying, it's like 43% is a first fill bourbon cask, and then the rest is new oak, split between the Cooper's Reserve, which we talked about before, which is the 24-month air-dried staves, heavy toast, lighter char, and the Cooper's Select, 18 months air-dried. And it's got a lighter toast and a heavier char. The split between the two ages is an interesting thing. We did this whole tasting across all the years of production that we did, this locally peated malt, and had these categories that we came up with, like is it peated? Is it releasable? Like, is it releasable now? And all these like confluence of factors. And this 2016, there's almost no smoke. It's all earthy. It tastes like a bog to a certain degree. I mean, that sounds like a terrible tasting note, but it really like was so earthy to the point of like, this is, I know where this is from. And then you bring in the 2019 with like the more traditional smoke signature on it, and they worked perfectly together.
Yeah. And on the palate here too, I'm getting lots of, it's super velvety, which is what I noticed immediately on kind of how the mouthfeel is on that. Effervescent, velvety, really, really unique mouthfeel there. But like kind of a fruit punch hookah almost, like tobacco-y, fruit punch full, super, super enjoyable. I mean, again, the smoke is very complimentary of the rest of the flavors there.
Yeah, I mean, this one definitely lends itself to you know, odd tasting notes, somewhat. I put rosemary bagel as a tasting note, because it's like it's that combination of like the rosemary getting a little bit singed, but like, you know, backed up by the grain notes of the bagel.
I love odd tasting notes, so it warms my heart to hear that. So with these expressions, we've gone through four expressions now and kind of dove pretty deep into them. So thanks for walking us through those different expressions that you're offering here at Westland. What's next? What are you excited to work on moving forward?
I mean, moving forward, like I said, we have like a tremendous amount of like different casts and combinations. So even within these outpost ranges, like they can end up varying more and more as time goes on. We started this program called the Cask Exchange Program, when we realized that a lot of brewers were aging beers in casks. There was a demand for it. So we said, okay, we'll loan you casks as long as you return them when you're done using them. No strings, like no rules besides, you know, don't destroy it. So we ended up building that program. And so we have a big stock of beer casks from Seattle and the greater area. So those are fun to work with. Keep working with some local wines, like to build up stocks from those. A lot of it is like contracting into where we're from, and like there's so much availability to make interesting whiskey within a pretty small radius of where we're actually distilling it and aging it.
Yeah, and when you talk about beer casks, are there any that you're really excited to work with?
Breweries are like beer types.
Beer types.
Oh, beer types.
I mean, breweries too. Why not?
Yeah, I don't really even try to like dictate a specific beer type. I just like, I'm not a brewer, so I think they could probably come up with more interesting things than I can. But we've had some fairly funky saisons that were made in white wine casks that, because of our program, we got from a brewery called Black Raven, We got also from them got a creek style, like a sour cherry style one. They've been doing some weird stuff. What's a little bit harder to wrap around is when hops become involved, which is an interesting challenge. I haven't landed on the solution for this yet because it's a powerful thing to have hops, and you don't necessarily want like a beer finished whiskey to taste like a beer. You know, it doesn't really lend itself, but you want to like pull the good notes and leave some of the like what can end up being soapier characteristics back. But I'm excited for what brewers can think up that are excited about their process.
Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned sour cherry. I feel like as soon as you said that, that's like a note that I got smelling the top of this glass here on the solemn. I mean,
Any cherry, like any possible form a cherry could be in, like you get it in our whiskeys. It's like the saison yeast, like there's something that's going on. It's like dried cherries, cooked cherries, like any cherry format you want, it's there.
And to that point, there's a lot of, like Shane was saying, there's a lot of potential for variation and the creation of some really exciting products because of, all of the different styles of casks that we have. In our efforts to make the Calere series, we've probably distilled 35 unique barley varieties to date. And it gives us a really interesting kind of spectrum of flavors to work with, and for Shane to blend and make those stories. But it's also a challenge. And so, 35 barley varieties, and many of them taste kind of similar. So the future for us is looking at what we've done and evaluating that and thinking about how to choose the right winners, right? Like, does a barley variety taste really good? Excellent. Does it grow really well? If it doesn't, well, we're going to refer that to a breeding program that we work with, and they can splice those genetics in, and we can carry on moving forward with something that works well throughout our entire supply chain. And so we're going to continue to do efforts like that, having releases that very much focus on that sense of community that we work in, and the really amazing opportunities that there are ahead of us. So yeah, you'll see some really exciting releases related to some of the kind of blending and marrying projects that Shane's got going on. We're doing a ton with grain and malt, and Scott Sell, who's our employee number two, he's been with us, I think, for 13 years now. He just won an award for Rack House Manager of the Year, but he manages our farm as well. So in addition to the bottling hall and the barrel aging, he runs a farm so that we can scale up any of these varieties that are developed, and then we can share them with nearby farmers. And so we're taking this approach as a very holistic means of making whiskey and trying to offload some of the risk and kind of share in the reward. And I'm really excited for the whiskey that we'll get to share with Mike and Rose and the rest of your listeners here.
Sure. It sounds like a bright, bright future for Westland coming up here. And, I've been doing some research on the distillery and the brand. Mentioned on the website that you're certified B Corp. Can you tell me a little bit more about that too?
Yeah, that's been a long endeavor that Scott Sell started the big push for a number of years ago. And really, it's about making sure that everybody that interacts with our business, whether that's the suppliers, the employees, our shareholders, they're all viewed as stakeholders, both in, some of the challenges that the business faces, but also in the opportunities and the kind of rewards. And so it's a really great way for us to keep ourselves accountable as we continue to grow and expand our scope, to make sure that we're doing right by the farmers and the maltsters, but also the employees, the distillers that are here keeping the lights on, and the front of the house tasting crew, and everyone else that we work with. It's really a commitment to doing right and making sure that it's not a transactional whiskey company. It's one that is very much of this place and of the people that make it so great.
Sure. And we're coming up pretty quickly at time, but I do want to get, we love a good old-fashioned origin story. So, Tyler and Shane, do you want to share how you got into working with Westland and how you wind up where you're at right now?
Yeah, sure. Tyler's mentioned him a couple of times, Scott Sell. I met many years ago, so I've been at Westland for over 11 years. Well, I started 6 months after Scott did. He was working there. They needed someone to work 10 hours a week. We used to have our wort contract brewed, and so my job 10 hours a week was driving just across this lot and filling a tank with the wort and coming back and filling fermenters and pitching the yeast. And eventually, I guess they just started to trust me enough. And I learned enough. I didn't know anything about whiskey going into it, which I think Matt Hoffman and Emerson, our two founders, enjoyed. So he didn't wasn't like held back by certain notions. So worked 10 hours a week and eventually came on full time and was full time distilling, full time mashing, and then did a little bit of QA on the production side, and then took over blending in 2016, which is kind of a fun time to take over blending. It was the very first Garryana release. So that holds sort of a special place in my heart as being like the beginning of when I was taking over on blending. So
Now
yeah.
let me ask you this. When you got into being the master blender, did you have one blend that really, elevated you as the guy who was going to be the master blender, or was this something you
As
were doing?
the
Yeah, the
dude,
dude, right?
I don't think particularly. I mean, everything we do is like a bit of a group effort and like working together. So like when I started doing vattings, and still now, like I'm always bringing in people, whether you work in the front of house or upstairs in the office, to drink it and tell me what you think, good and bad. I always like to taste people blind sometimes on our own whiskeys and get some negative reactions. But so I like to bring in people, and usually they'll say one thing or another, oh, can it be this or can it be that? And whether if I agree with them or not, I like to try to do that. Oh, can it be fruitier? Can it be this? Can you focus this note? Because then if I try to do it, it's just helping my skills and knowing what's possible. I go into a lot of situations in blending just almost telling myself I don't know anything and prove it. I don't be like, oh, if I add this, it's gonna bring this particular blackberry note. It's like if I think that going into it, it's gonna happen. So let's test everything.
Yeah, and those preconceived notions can be completely wrong sometimes. At least that's what I've found in my own home blending experiments. I'm like, if I could add this to this, I would get this, and I go, that did not work out.
Yeah, usually I tend to work backwards. I get the whole like prototype built, and obviously it has its component parts, which I refer to as sub blends. So I have my sub blends and I have the like final prototype sizes, different ones. I taste the prototypes and then I trace backwards to what might be giving it the character, as opposed to the other way around.
And I love the notion of using your own casks too, with some of these new expressions.
Yeah, it's like it's our a bit of a secret weapon because
Yeah.
they sit in between new and used oak. Like I don't know anyone else who has the same tool, because they give like more of a classic oak characteristics than an ex bourbon will, but it's not as punchy as a new oak, so it can sit in the middle, and it's a really cool blending tool.
Yeah. And that the only thing I can think of is we're big Pretty Lights fans, the EDM artist, and he released this album called Color Map of the Sun, and he recorded his own album, then he pressed it to vinyl, then he remixed his own album, and it feels a little bit like that when you're using your own used Westland casks into these new expressions. It's such a cool and unique thing.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Did you go to the Red Rocks show?
I've been to a few of them in my day, and rumor is he's coming back this year, so we'll see.
Yeah, circling back.
Absolutely. I can relive my college days.
Yeah, that's you. That's you. You're reblending yourself.
And thank you for the background on you and how you got into this. Tyler, do you want to share a little bit of your origin stories and how you became a superhero
Yeah, super villain.
or supervillain here at Westland?
Well, I guess I grew up in a family that owned restaurants, so the food and beverage industry always seemed like it was going to be somewhere in my orbit. But growing up, seeing those restaurants fail, I understood that running the business probably wasn't going to be for me. So I gained plenty of experience in both front and back of the house. But when I was in school, I really fell in love with science and ecology specifically. Although I hated chemistry, or I was afraid of chemistry. So I
yeah,
never
me too.
Had a single chemistry class. And through college, I was bartending, working at breweries, wineries, hospitality, you name it. And then one day as a barback, I just turned around and I saw all of that variation in the whiskey behind me. And I was like, whoa, that's pretty cool. I also, I loved art growing up, but I can't sing, I can't draw, I can't dance. Like, I have no artistic form of expression.
Me too.
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, well, there's like this science of creating ethanol, but an art form of making it taste great. And, I loved ecology in school and this notion of how different complex systems interact and those relationships and how they're developed. And I felt that there was probably an avenue for me to kind of scratch that itch in whiskey. I didn't know it. I didn't really know much about it, but I started kind of doing the self-taught thing in the deep, dark corners of the internet and a little bit of home distilling and whatever I could to gain experience. I worked very briefly at the Woodinville Whiskey Distillery in production for about 6 weeks. And then eventually I just kept my head to the floor and I saw that the local bartenders guild was going to do this tour of this brand new shiny distillery. They posted a picture of the stainless steel and the copper and it was professional. So I printed up my resume that day because I knew the bartenders would probably have the same idea. Sprinted down to Westland Distillery and they weren't open to the public. There was nobody
sprinted
here.
There.
Yeah. I drove as fast as I could. And fortunately, they weren't open to the public, but Matt, the founder, happened to be walking towards the front of the building. He saw me like leaning in, like knocking on the windows. And he opened the door and I said, look, you guys are obviously a startup and probably can't afford to take on any new employees, but I would love to volunteer my time until you can take me on. And he was like, no, thank you. We don't need anybody. And he sent me on my way. And then 2 weeks later, their mashman quit. So my resume was just top of the pile. I was able to get a salary, thankfully, and did mashing for about 4 or 5 months before moving on to distillation. Was head stillman for 5 years before I started managing. Then got the nod to the kind of master distiller role in November.
Okay, very cool. I love both of those stories about how you got into this and what you've been doing. And I imagine you'll have long, prosperous careers here at Westland with some of the cool things that you guys are doing.
Yeah, hopefully.
Real quick, lightning round questions. What is your favorite thing about the job?
I was just going to say smelling, but that was just, if it's a lightning round. It's one of those weird senses you just don't like. It's like not really considered that much, but it has so much power. Like how much your memory can like flick to very particular points in time when you smell something.
Sure.
So well, to have it revolve around something that simple is just like cool.
Yeah, weirdest note I ever got was lava rocks. I was smelling some Highland Park 12, and I swear it smelled like lava rocks. Transported me back to when my family did vacation in Hawaii for forever ago. And like you said, it's such a weird thing associating smells with memories.
For me, I think what's compelling about this industry is I am a supreme introvert. Like I would much rather just not talk to anybody and just be on my couch doing my own thing. But this industry offers me an opportunity to like get out there, share a dram, talk about barley, talk to farmers, and really like just let my nerd wings fly, because like otherwise I'm just super content to not talk to anybody. So getting the opportunity to connect and do something in a really interesting way is what keeps me coming back.
You never would have guessed it by the conversation we're having right now.
See, I need this like forced interaction to bring me out of my shell.
But I find myself being an introverted extrovert too. But when you come to start talking to people about whiskey and expressions, there's so much you can dive into and such a robust field of things that you can carry a conversation about, especially when you're living it, you're breathing it. you are passionate about it and you want to share those experiences with other people. So such a cool thing.
Absolutely.
And with that said, thank you so much to our guests this evening from Westland Distillery, Master Distiller Tyler Peterson, Master Blender Shane Armstrong. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. Before we go, where can people find Westland Distillery? What's the best way to connect with you guys?
So yeah, if you want to find Westland, I highly recommend reaching out to westlanddistillery.com or Our West is Whiskey for a more kind of in-depth dive to our brand and some of the cool stuff we're working on. And they'll be able to point you into the direction of getting a bottle into your hand.
Very cool. You know where to find us. We're All Things Whiskey Podcast. You can go to allthingswhiskeypodcast.com. Instagram's All Things Whiskey Podcast. Facebook's All Things Whiskey. TikTok's All Things Whiskey. We're over there. If you can find a podcast on iTunes, Spotify, anywhere else, Google, you can find us. We love bringing you content like this and chatting with awesome brands like Westland. So Tyler, Shane, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Had a blast chatting about Westland Distillery.
Yes. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Rose.
With that said, I'm your host, Mike Outcault, signing off. Keep drinking tasty whiskeys.